from KQED.
Hey, everybody, from KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer, KQED Senior Politics Editor.
I'm Marisa Lagos, part of the politics posse around here, and today on The Breakdown, we are thrilled to have with us a job applicant who's hoping the voters hire him to be the governor of California.
That's right, Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, the Democratic former mayor of San Francisco, looking for a little promotion to the top job and replace Jerry Brown when he leaves office in January.
Jerry Brown is indeed leaving office,
we hear. The last time.
We should say we've also invited Republican candidate John Cox. We're hoping he'll join us before the election.
He has our phone number, right? He does.
I know
he does.
His people definitely do. Yeah.
So let's sort of set this up for our listeners and for our guests. You know, people who have listened to this show, I think, know that this program is not about grilling our guests about policy. Okay.
In fact, we don't let them.
I like that. You know, that's what I prefer.
Barbara Lee came in with like five, you know, reams full of policy papers.
Yeah,
and
like
I said, put it away.
Where's your matrix of accountability?
Oh, I got it in my head now. I don't even need to bring it with me.
We should say, though, that, you know, there are places, a lot of places for that on KQED. For example, kqed.org/elections.
That's right. We're covering the election in many forms. You can also tune in for the debate next week between Newsom and Cox. That's going to be on Forum. Our own Scott Schaefer is hosting, and
he is
at 10 a.m. on October 8th. It'll be on KQED Public Radio and playing on public radio stations around the state.
Yeah. So, but for now, Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom.
This is a preview of
the
debate.
Nice to see you.
Yes. We'll see. You're in the room.
Oh, no. I'm interested.
So as we said.
Why didn't he ask that? He's going to ask it in the debate. We're going to analyze
your
questions.
Don't overthink it.
Now that you anticipated we overthink. So now I'm overthinking that.
We almost always start this show. And we didn't really intend to do this when we started the show. But we almost always ask our guests about their childhoods. And so you, it's interesting with you because you have been portrayed in public life in such different ways.
Yeah, no,
as a son of privilege, someone who was born with connections, and then somebody who was raised by a single mom who sometimes was on food stamps. So how do you reconcile those two images?
Well, my sister loves reading these profiles on me. She says, boy, it's just a completely different life than the one that is the narrative. And the narrative is it's not well informed, but it's well established, and it's hard to break it. So the fact is, people go Google anytime there's a new profile on me. They look back at old profiles, and it sort of extends that narrative. And it's been that case for 20 plus years. I can't fight it. I can't defeat it. But
let's set the record straight here.
The reality is very different, and so I live with a different reality. And was a mom who was pregnant with me as a teenager, dropped out of Chico State, had two kids, and was raising them on her own. A few years later, was separated and divorced from my father. She came from no wealth whatsoever, and she struggled her entire life. And she had quite literally two jobs, two full-time jobs, and often a part-time job as a bookkeeper. She worked for Aid to Adoption of Special Kids, the DeBolt family, of kids with intellectual and physical disabilities. She worked in many different facets, including in the restaurant industry, one of the reasons I ended up in the restaurant business. And my father, an extraordinary man, he's still with us. My mom passed away 18-ish years ago, breast cancer. My dad, 84, struggling with a little bit of dementia, living in a wheelchair and diapers. He's still a big part of my life, but he didn't raise me. But he had a huge influence.
Well, talk a little bit about that because, he was a judge.
Yeah.
You know, he was not like, you know, flipping burgers. I mean,
Quite the contrary.
Yeah. So talk about your relationship with your dad, who wasn't around a lot.
He was a lawyer up in Truckee, California, for most of my childhood. So he lived up in the Sierras. He lived up in Placer County for period of time, but primarily up in the Squaw Valley area. And he did odd jobs. He had a little part-time gig doing ice cream at Swenson's Ice Cream. He did a little bit of work as, you know, with the old river rafting operations there in Truckee. And he was, part-time on the side doing some legal work. That was primarily his life. He came from a really large family and helped support a lot of those family members. But he never, he didn't come from a great deal of wealth. He had the privilege of a lot of interesting relationships. And I think that's what's been highlighted, which should be the story of his life more than the story of my life. But nonetheless, nonetheless, he was an extraordinary example because my time with him was during the summer, and it was always around a river trip. It was always around a cause. To the extent I saw him, it would be every few months. We'd be at a dinner for Friends of the River and Environmental Defense Fund, legal support for this year. Whatever it was always around a cause. And so the combination of my mom, hard work and grit, don't complain, don't explain, single mom, and then my dad's sense of idealism and adventure in terms of solving life's great problems was really the real privilege I had in my life.
So growing up mostly in your mom's household, which I understand was in San Francisco, and then you guys moved up to Marin.
Yeah.
How old were you then?
I was in, I think, the sixth, seventh grade. Okay. Bounced around to schools. I had pretty severe learning disability as a kid and still do. I mean, it doesn't go away. You just overcompensate for it. And it's one of the great struggles I have still that, you know, you rarely see me read a speech. And if you do, you can tell.
Which is
difficult.
Yeah. And we're talking about dyslexia, I believe.
Yeah.
How old were you when that was diagnosed? And how did that affect kind of your school life, how you interacted with other kids?
Yeah, I was always after school. I didn't know that wasn't normal. And I ultimately sort of, not only was after school, I was sort of tracked with the other kids, quote unquote, the ones that were sort of self-paced, where had more of an individualized learning plan. And that shaped a lot of my perspective and bias. But the dyslexia was the greatest gift that ever happened to me because I didn't, nothing was rote, nothing was linear. I had to work around things, work differently, see the world differently, struggled academically, but had to make up for that in different ways. And in the construct of making up for it, you learn about other aspects of your life, you straighten out other aspects of your life. And it allowed me to think outside the box. I've always been willing to take risks because you have to, because you're never going to thrive in the more traditional sense. But it was hard for my mom. I think, anybody that's got kids, and by the way, I have two kids that already have been early diagnosed.
Wow.
And I struggle just trying to read with them, and it breaks my heart. And I'm realizing it was even more powerful and potent, the impact it had on her. Of course, she's not around for me to express that. She never got a chance to meet my kids.
I don't know if what you just described is related to this, but you talked about all the old profiles. I went back and there was a Rolling Stone magazine article about you, and this is what you said. A lot of people talk in colorful three dimensions about their childhood. For me, so much of it is blocked out. It's not bad. It's not good. It's just blocked.
Interesting.
What do you mean by that?
I love that. It's so funny you bring that up, because I was just reflecting on those hearings last week on Kavanaugh and the sort of nuance to which people are able to remember some of their high school. It's all that's blurry, just broadly speaking. Childhood.
Was that a defense, do you think?
I wonder. I mean, I honestly do wonder. And yeah, I think you just sort of get through the day. I mean, I don't want to over-dramatize. I mean, my mom, we're hardly indigent. I mean, this is not, I've never tried to compete for those stories. But I am saying, like a lot of folks, those struggles were real. And I remember those crying nights listening to my mom talk to my dad on the phone. And those are indelible moments. And you too try to block those things out. And you don't necessarily romanticize them. There was no abuse. It was love, and I was blessed. But it wasn't, as you're right. It's I don't paint in bold colors those early memories.
I'm always amazed by people who have these, picture memories of their childhood.
High school calendars.
Anyway,
calendars.
That's a whole nother. So one of the things we are hearing a lot about is your family's connection to the Gettys and some of the other very storied families of San Francisco. I know your dad was close with Gordon Getty. I mean, talk about that. And how did you reconcile that world when it came into your world with where you were
living?
It was
a once-a-year world. There would be maybe every, when I got older, and we would go on a vacation once a year, and you'd have this extraordinary experience. And then you'd have my mom sitting there waiting for me to get home, said, I hope you had a nice time.
Oh, yeah, that must have been hard
for
her.
And that was it. Like, anything else?
But were you, were you?
And you're like, okay, guess I should feel guilty about this. Back to reality.
Because she didn't go on that.
Yeah, you work in a Jeff Hicks construction paper route. I mean, quite literally, for years and years, janitorial job here in San Francisco. I go through all those buildings downtown. I'm like, I remember cleaning the toilets, quite literally cleaning the toilets, not figuratively. So it just, it completely sort of bifurcated hybrid reality. But it shaped a lot. I also don't have, for me, I don't have a lot of aspiration for great wealth. As a consequence, I see not just the glamour of it, I see another side of it as well. And so, I had that experience, and yet the vast majority, 360 days of my year, were a different reality than those 5 days a year that were obviously expressed in that time with my father and that family.
Well, your dad, I know, obviously had a lot of connections to politicians, but I'm curious, I mean, were politics something you guys talked about
It was,
growing
I
up?
Couldn't escape. If I was with my father, it was cause, which slash meant politics. I'd be, you know, and not here to promote, but North Beach restaurants, my just indelible early seared in memory with my dad around the table back in the George Moscone days, though I was very, very young, but to Jerry Brown, to Quentin Copps, a lot of old time San Francisco politicos, that was my dad's world. John Burton, Willie Brown, all these folks. So I grew up in and around that. And my father was very, you know, I remember licking envelope for Jerry Brown's presidential run. And
Which one?
I know. There's one. That's the right question.
It's a lot of envelopes.
By the way, I would honestly need to check with my lawyer to see which one. I don't want to be accused of forgetting it was early or late. But I just, yeah, so politics was always present. And, you know, we were a Sarge Shriver family, Bobby Kennedy family. There's still a picture with my dad. I went to visit him last 2 nights ago. And he had brought back, my sister brought back that great photo, or at least for us, it's a great photo of my dad and Bobby Kennedy, literally 2 days before he was killed. Oh, my dad was running for state senate against Milton Marks.
Wow.
And it was signed to my mother, Tessa. So it's a very precious piece for us. It's the one you'd sort of risk everything to get out of a fire. And so that, you know, that photo in many ways, I look at that symbolically and substantively as something that really triggered subconsciously in me where I am today.
We are talking with Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom. In case you haven't heard, he's running for governor. He'll be on the ballot in November. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos here with Scott Schaefer and Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, who is running to be governor of the Golden State. We want to talk about, obviously, your career. You started off not in politics, but as a businessman. You opened a wine shop up in San Francisco's Marina District. You kind of alluded to this earlier, but why wine? Why that sort of arena?
Connection with my father, period, full stop. I mean, you know, classic divorce family, and you're going to try to find ways to connect with your dad. My dad, you know, one of those erudite folks, reminds me a lot of Jerry Brown, and not surprisingly, they're old friends, but, you know, extraordinarily well-read, intellectual, and here's his son struggling to read, you know, struggling academically, and so you just find those pathways to connect with your father, and he's an old Irish Catholic father, if you know, sort of there's a meme there. I don't mean to be disparaging to my tribe, but there's sort of, you know, there's a meme there. And so, you know, it's hard to connect with him. He loved wine, though. And so you just study what your dad studies and what he identifies with. And I remember having a little wine cellar, even in high school, of 3 bottles.
You had a wine cellar
in
high school?
Yeah, 3 bottles. You know, like,
did you have calendars?
Here's
also
my bottle of, Mondavi Coastal Chardonnay. And people would come over. And I mean, things I'd steal from my dad or something, or at least borrow from him, I should say. And so, you know, I always developed an appreciation. I developed appreciation, but through that lens. And then there was just a happenstance and opportunity. I was working for Walter Sorenstein right out of college. I was working part-time delivering orthotics for a podiatrist out of Burlingame. I was literally a delivery boy right out of college. Thought we maybe could do something a little bit more and better. Got a part-time real estate license because my mom was working part-time real estate. Went to Anthony's to do the real estate. Somehow passed. Went to visit Walter Sorenstein to get some advice. And lo and behold, I had an $18,000 or $19,000 a year job at the Rust Building, 235 Montgomery, 9 to 5. And my boss, Craig Edwards, was basically, you got to get out of here. This is not for you. Not that I was doing a terrible job. He's like, this is not for you.
How did you sell orthotics?
I just want to say this. If I blow this damn governor's race, I got a backup plan. I was pretty good.
That was before GPS.
Sell me an orthotic.
I'm just saying it was a whole different thing. Once you look the mean streets of the Bay Area, once you figure out to navigate them, but I basically know where every podiatrist is. So.
Well, things have changed a little. If you've heard with Lyft and Uber.
I know. Now you got all these competitors to old-fashioned guys like me. They've been out of work.
So
that's a whole big issue. Automation. Work. Future of work.
So
but we
sounds
can't
like,
talk politics.
You know, we're not talking politics.
We'll do that later.
It sounds like politics is a big part of your life, but did you ever imagine going into it? I know Willie Brown appointed you to a city commission before the Board of Supervisors.
Parking. Yeah,
oh, God, I'm sorry.
Chair of the parking and traffic. I mean, what is chair? I had no idea. I think someone from local Cron 4 News asked me, what's my vision? I said something like, I pay my parking tickets. I don't even know what chair meant. I was the president of the damn Parking and Traffic Commission. By the way, Willie didn't tell anybody. I got a call from, I think, Eleanor Johns, his chief of staff or his, you know, main person, and said, hey, the mayor wants to appoint you to film commission. I'm like, nice. 22, 3 years old, film commission. Now you're talking.
Thinking possibilities.
I'm thinking this is, you know, it's more in line with my expertise at the time. I didn't have much.
I'm
a small
movies.
Little business. I'm just being honest here. I mean, this is full. This, you know, I'm being way too honest, Fred. And so I go down to the temporary city hall, and there's like 50 of us, and everyone's raising, and he says a few things about everybody, and he says, and my new chair of the parking and traffic. And didn't tell anyone. Apparently, he told no one. They told him all the empty positions, and classic Willie Brown.
Just slotted you in.
So baptism by fire, inspiration, desperation. I'm running meetings. And it was that time we were actually raising the upper deck of the Central Freeway, and there was actually some real issues. Mm. We had big problems with PCOs at the time. We didn't call them
parking control officers.
Yeah, I called them meter maids, and
that's
we changed
cool
the vernacular to parking control. We did parking control officers of the month, and I started getting them rewards and identifying with gift certificates because they were being abused, the racial epithets. People wrote the nastiest things on their ticket, blaming these folks for doing their job. We had one person that was shot out with a pellet gun, and it created an empathy. I dug deep into the trying to survive and try to even thrive in that position, and it really created the conditions where ultimately Willie Brown appointed me to the Board of Supervisors.
Well, let's jump off from there, because from there you ran for mayor in 2003. Willie Brown's termed out, and you ran or were portrayed as the conservative, business-friendly candidate.
I know.
Which you were a businessman.
I was a business guy, yeah.
I know. Was San Francisco.
Four businesses back then, five or six.
And everything's relative.
Yeah, so I had a restaurant. I opened the wine store, opened a little restaurant, another restaurant, got involved in a hotel. And
but that worked,
winery.
Obviously. I mean, you were sort of a centrist.
I'm still passionate pro-business Democrat. You can't be pro-job and anti-business, and I've always maintained that. First thing I did as lieutenant governor, I don't mean to fast forward, but was put out an economic development plan for the state. Got me a little crosshairs, candidly, with the governor.
Yes.
I learned I was lieutenant governor, not governor. But the point is, that's never left me, and I'm deeply entrepreneurial in trying to solve problems, not just manage problems. And, you know, we have 23 businesses now, over 800 employees, and that's not to impress anyone, but that's a big part of the narrative that I bring into the work I try to do. And my willingness, again, to take risks, iterate, to be audacious in terms of goal setting, which opens me up for criticism, falling short of goals. But that's all part of that business background. And one of the things that entrepreneurs learn, you got to be accountable. You got to take responsibility. You can't blame other people for the way the world is. So I try to bring that into the work I did as supervisor. And business really has shaped my life in a profound and deep way. And it's really, I think, if I add any value, I think it's substantively from that lens and a social justice lens.
So one of the big things you ran on was this Care Not Cash initiative, which for people outside of San Francisco is this idea, instead of giving folks who are homeless cash assistance, that they should get housing. It was very controversial. I guess I'm curious, like, where did that idea come from? And were you surprised by the blowback? Because we've sort of talked about how you're a centrist by San Francisco terms.
Yeah, I mean, this reinforced that centrist image, candidly. Because, look, I'm not ideological. I'm open argument, interested in evidence. And I was a member of the Board of Supervisors complicit in this respect, that every year we've increased our cash-based assistance. It got close to $300 when I first started, and then we got it close to $400. And I realized, wait a second, every month we're adding more money, more people are on our rolls, and there are more problems. Crime rates were on the first, second, third of the month, 15th, 16th, and 17th are up. We see overdoses, what we call emergency room diversions in our emergency rooms. And I started realizing the problem was getting worse, not better. And so what I did is the same thing I do in business. Best practices. What are our competitors doing? So I went out, quite literally, went out to meet with Mayor Daley in Chicago and went out to Cook County. I went to New York and went to Brooklyn, Queens, the Bronx, Harlem, and some of the boroughs to learn about best practices. I started studying the issue, Utah and others. Came back and realized, you know what? We're doing something nobody else is doing. And that led to the policy. But nothing more powerful than this. The founder of the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic, I had an opportunity to talk to him. And he said, you're basically killing people and you're complicit. And you're part of the problem. You're basically handing out checks, and many people are out there self-medicating, and they're literally injecting those checks, and you are complicit. That changed everything for me and gave me the moral authority, not just as a supervisor, the formal authority to move forward with an effort to address it.
So there was that, and then there was gay marriage in 2004, where you defied basically the law and told this.
And my Irish Catholic roots.
Yeah.
Which, trust me, was the hardest part.
Yeah.
My base.
And so I've heard you talk about this, you know, on Pod Save America and other places. But, you know, was that a, you portrayed it as something that came to you when you were back at in D.C.
100%.
For the State of the Union speech. I mean, was the city attorney behind you on this?
Nope.
The people.
I don't want to get in trouble.
Lawyer.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's so much I want to say about what happened and what didn't happen, but there's so many good people I admire that I'd you know, run over a little bit on this stuff. And that's hard for me, and it's hard to square that. And that's, you know, in good people on all sides of this. And by the way, back to my father, I mean, he had a really difficult time with this. Well, he said, can't you just call it something else? But, civil unions were not even really even being debated then. It was Howard Dean, and Vermont was the only one even getting there. But it never came up in the campaign trail, not once. I even asked Matt Gonzalez not too many years ago. I said, Matt, seriously. Who I ran against. And I said, was there a questionnaire thing? He said, I vaguely remember a questionnaire. And I said, maybe there was a questionnaire, and I don't know how either of us responded, but it was novel, and it certainly was triggered by that experience in Washington, D.C., watching the State of the Union, George Bush's re-election State of the Union, where he's talking about abstinence, drug testing, issues of steroid abuse, and then, of course, the denouement was a constitutional amendment to support same-sex marriage. And it was the way he said it, and it was the way the people that I met after the speech referred to, quote-unquote, the homosexual agenda, and it just seared in my mind a need to do something. I didn't know what. And then a week or two later, it manifested.
I never got that memo for the agenda.
Yeah. Oh, come on, Scott. I thought there was a safe somewhere agenda. With it.
Must have gone to my spam filter.
So you were in office in San Francisco for a fairly long time. And I think besides gay marriage, one of the biggest things people know about you is the scandal where you had an affair with someone who worked for you and who was married to somebody else who worked for you.
I'd like to think universal health care was on that list and our progressive environmental policies, implementing universal preschool. There are a lot of other extraordinary things I'm very proud of.
Yes, but I do want to know, what did you learn from that time in your life? And what do you carry with you?
I've answered that so many times. It was a reset. I mean, I learned an enormous amount. It was an opportunity to take pause, reflect. I mean, you're just running full speed.
I mean, 110. You were young. You were...
Yeah, I mean, young, no excuse. I mean, I learned that I had to grow up that moment. And I had to reconcile something that I did that was wrong. I had to own it. Mm-hmm. I had to take account. I had to take responsibility. I had to be transparent. And I had to make a decision. Do I lean back and allow the weight of what I did to collapse on me? Or do I move forward in a transparent way and try to build on that experience in a way where I can come out a better person and be a better representative of the people of San Francisco and at the end of the day, come out as an example of someone that you know, truly can reconcile and ultimately make amends the extent one can and then try to do everything in my life going forward to make up for it.
Yeah. Well, you know, in that vein, I know that you have always dated and married very strong women. You're... ex is now dating Donald Trump Jr., which is a whole nother podcast.
That's a lot of the show.
I know. When talk policy. I love policy.
Yeah. Well, no, I want to talk about something that I know you like talking about, which is your wife and your family, because Jennifer Siebel Newsom, who you married how long ago?
10 years. Ago? 10 years and a few months.
She's a very outspoken feminist.
Yeah.
She is
She was the second one out
filmmaker.
On the Harvey Weinstein issues.
Yeah.
Literally the second publicly. Yeah.
So talk a little bit about your guys' relationship, how you found each other, and you have four kids now.
Four.
I mean,
I know.
This is you're
crazy.
A very different
so many.
Person in some ways than you were when you were mayor.
I know. Well, I was 30 in my young 30s back as mayor, and now I don't want to talk about my age. I mean, it's different times.
I think you're 50.
There's literally time of life, but there's also a state of mind. There's a maturation when you have kids. That's a pattern interrupt. That's a game changer in terms of accountability, responsibility, constancy. There's no vacation. There's no, you know, no sick leave at home.
We call them trips now.
Yeah,
not
whatever.
Vacations.
What do you mean? Whatever you want to exactly, however you want to describe it, you can't escape that responsibility. And there's a deep love, and you understand that term in a completely different way that only a parent can understand. And that gives you tremendous depth of empathy. And I hope grace as well, even for others that you may disagree with, that you realize there's commonality. That even my, you know, folks that attack me, still they're parents as well. They love their kids, and I think it allows you to bond together more broadly too. And so I just, in every way, shape, or form, a different person. And Jen, of course, is a rock star, as you suggest. She's now working on her fifth film called The Great American Lie on Wealth and Income Inequality in the United States through a gender lens, not who's to blame, but how it impacts genders very differently.
So this governor thing.
Yes, sir.
You alluded to Jerry Brown and kind of knowing him when you were young, and then becoming
mayors together too. You remember?
What's that?
He was mayor of Oakland.
Yeah. Oh, that's right.
Mayor of San Francisco.
Right.
People
yes.
forget that.
You overlapped. Yeah. Then you both ran for governor in 2000 for a short time.
And then he jumped in and I thought better of it.
Yeah. And so as you wisely kind of alluded to this, you had kind of a rocky relationship
at the beginning,
with
yeah.
Jerry Brown. And so how did that evolve and how did you get through that? And like, how do you apportion the blame for that?
Oh, I'll take this one. I'm one of those guys that, you know, it's my biggest gripe with Donald Trump besides his policies is the victimization that he espouses. I feel very differently. I take responsibility, period. I mean, it's like someone saying, hey, you know, I'm stuck in traffic. I'll be there late. And you're like, no, you're not stuck in traffic. You are traffic. You know,
what does that mean?
It means we are our behaviors. Society becomes how we behave. Next time you're stuck in traffic, consider the fact you're part of the problem. The point being—
I walk to work.
You walk to work.
So
you're
smug.
You get the point. I mean, the point is, yeah, no, I take responsibility. When something goes wrong, when relationships go south, take account to your own relationship to the issue. And so I learned a lot from that. And, you know, look, I'm someone, again, I'm going to make mistakes. I will take risks. I'm not reckless in life. I've done some things that I will permanently regret. I do things that I don't regret that I learned from that were mistakes. And one of them is a perfect example. I came out with an economic development plan, worked with McKinsey and the Brookings Institute, traveled the country virtually and physically to learn about best practices on economic development, had a press conference, about 1,000 people showed up. That was a mistake. I don't regret that mistake.
Because it was overshadowing
him. I got ahead of the skis. You know, Jerry was dealing with a $27 billion budget deficit. I was focused on the 12.4% unemployment.
I had a business
background, and it wasn't his priority at the moment, and he's the governor, I'm not. And he was right, I was wrong. In that respect, though I don't regret the effort, I do regret not being respectful enough of where he was at that moment. And I hope the next lieutenant governor considers that example.
Did you two talk about that?
No, it's hard. Talking to Jerry about these kinds of things is never easy. I mean, and also there's a familiarity issue. I've just known him forever. You know, Kathleen Brown's godfather is my grandfather. My grandfather ran Pat Brown's campaign or chaired it for district attorney in San Francisco. It goes back generationally. And so there is a familiarity that also often breeds, I don't want to say contempt because that's a quotable thing. And so so I'm not going to say that. So I went out of my way to correct that statement. The familiarity meant this relationship is a little different, put it that way, than the traditional lieutenant governor-governor relationship.
Well, I think we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for coming
Look at
in.
We'll have you back and talk about homelessness. Nice about Jerry. You notice that?
Yes.
I'm being very indulgent there, for the record.
We'll tell him.
Would you tell him? I know he'll
care deeply. He listens. Thank you so much for coming in. That does it for this edition of Political Breakdown. It's a production of KQED Public Radio.
You can also subscribe to our brand new weekly newsletter that will drop all our top political coverage right into your inbox. That's at kqed.org/politicalbreakdown.
Our producer is Guy Marzorati, and our engineer this week, Seal Muller.
Ethan Lindsay is our executive editor, and Holly Kernan is our chief content officer. I'm Marisa Lagos. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at @mlagos.
I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me at Twitter. I'm @ScottSchaefer. That's a wrap for this week's Political Breakdown from KQED. We'll see you next time, everybody.
Bye.